is the New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello again and welcome to the show. Coming up, we take a look at the deteriorating season, particularly in the south of the state, and new gun laws will take effect in New South Wales this year. But the calls for exemptions for farmers and sporting shooters are getting louder. You can always send us a text, 0467 922 684. But first up today, let's turn our attention to the season, because we're hearing that things are not great in the south of the state. Following that dry spell, around half of New South Wales is in drought now or affected by drought, and there doesn't seem to be any relief in sight. Anthony Clark is an agricultural climatologist with the DPI, says the La Nina system that had been affecting northern Australia and increasing the rainfall probability, it's now on the wane. He says farmers in the south are now running out of water for livestock, dam levels are low, pasture and grass levels are decreasing rapidly, and the impending heat wave will suck out more soil moisture.
Yeah, absolutely, Michael. Unfortunately, after a little bit of rain early on in spring, things have really dried out across the Riverina, Murray and parts of the far west of the state. There's some real kind of intense belts through there where we're seeing in particular our soil moisture indicators really take a dive. Concerningly, we're seeing quite low levels of water available for livestock, and that's a real critical pressure at the moment.
And what about like ground cover, grass, you know, things like that?
Yeah, even though we had that bit of rain off the back of winter and early spring, in the big scheme of things, it's been quite ineffective. Importantly, the high temperatures as well have really knocked the nutrition out of the pastures at this time of year. So, you know, even if you do have a bit of pick there, it's of quite low feed quality at the moment. So, yeah, pretty tough, tight conditions for people in that part of the state.
And as we head further north, does it improve? Is it better in the central west and beyond?
Yeah, look, unfortunately, again, that sort of drying out in late November into December has continued for parts of the central west. It does improve as you come a bit further to the east. And yeah, pockets to the north, you know, as you get to the far north of the state, things are still looking quite good. But there is some tough conditions in the central west and central tablelands at the moment as well.
Yeah, and hearing from that, some people around Tamworth, Narrabri, pretty dry as well, even though they have probably had more than their, you know, more rain than the people down south in Riverina.
Yeah, look, they had quite a good winter, unreasonable rain in spring. But, as usual, as we get into summer, the storms come through, quite high variability, quite hot conditions. So, you know, we're seeing the temperature, high temperatures through evaporation really strip moisture out of the landscape, in most parts of the state.
And what sort of percentage, you know, drought are we looking at for the state at the moment, or those affected by drought or actually in drought?
We're looking, in terms of that overall drought-affected category, we're looking at nearly 50% of the state, in that category. Only 38, 40% of what we call in the non-drought category. So, we've seen that drought footprint intensify in areas where it's been around for a while and just expand into the parts of the central west, up into the far west as well.
But at the moment, obviously, the crop's off. So though we're talking about people that are impacted by this are livestock producers, sheep and cattle.
Yeah, that's right. It's always a bit of a mixed bag in terms of impacts, depending on the way people's businesses are set up. We have been hearing some quite reasonable crops coming off through the southern grain belt down to, crops that people have pretty much written off and using for feed. So people are selling some of that, written off crop into the feed market as well. So, yeah, again, a real mixed bag for the cropping industry in terms of its outcomes in southern New South Wales.
And we're expecting pretty hot weather for the next few days or so in many parts of the state. So, you know, it'll be a while before we see a reprieve by the looks of things.
Yeah, in the short term, we've got a bit of a heat wave being forecast for the next couple of days. It'll continue to strip moisture out of the system and, you know, create a fairly uncomfortable environment for us all and livestock as well. So, you know, people are getting ready for that. In the longer term, the outlook for, you know, the coming season, you know, out until the start of autumn is pretty much neutral across New South Wales. There's no really strong signal either way, unfortunately. So we're starting to see the La Nina, which has been around in the system until September, and that's brought a quite a bit of high rainfall up in the far north of Australia. Starting to see that breakdown is actually forecast to break down by autumn.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Mm. So that would mean they'll sort of get back into neutral conditions. So, you know, hoping for like an average season, but an average season this time of year is pretty dry.
Yeah, that's correct. Average conditions at the moment are very high evaporation rates and storm rainfall. So, yeah, quite challenging conditions at the end of summer leading into autumn. And at this point, not a strong signal for an autumn break, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I guess the other thing is too, with the heat wave conditions, not a lot of water on the ground, people might be a bit worried about their stock and, you know, their welfare in these hot conditions if they continue beyond a few days.
Yeah, that's right. Availability of livestock water is a real concern at the moment. We do have the Southern Drought Coordinator out and about in the Riverina Murray, making sure there's a lot of visibility of government programs and things are better coordinated. You know, people should jump on to New South Wales Drought Hub, have a look at what resources are available. If you dig into the water resources section, there's some really good information about management of stock water, management of dams, doing really good assessments. Good idea to have that water budget this time of year quite accurate.
Anthony Clark is an agricultural climatologist with the Department of Primary Industries and Regional Development. The dry seasonal conditions, rather than China's beef tariffs, they were the key talking points at the first cattle sale for the year in Wagga Wagga. China will, of course, impose a 55% tariff on Aussie beef exports above our quota of 205,000 tonnes. That's a move which is forecast to cost the industry up to $1 billion. Reporter Emily Doak went to the Wagga cattle sale to see how producers and agents feel about the move.
Gary Hindmarsh from up at Adelong. Oh, it's never good if you've got tariffs, but we're still going to get a fair bit in there before they tariff us. So there's other markets in the world that's got to chase them up.
Is it something that you think the Australian government should be pushing to try and overturn?
Probably, but I don't think they can overturn everything. It's just up to finding more markets. You can't put all eggs in the one basket.
Jeff Carter, Big Springs. Yes, it's a concern, but it's only on above quota stock. And, you know, who knows how much that will affect it. But I think still plenty of meat going to America and everywhere else.
Wagga Regional Livestock Director Isaac Hill says it's too early to tell what impact the Chinese tariffs will have.
I mean, the reality is, yes, it's a tariff and it is hefty, but it comes into effect after we've exported 205,000 tonnes of beef, where I think that for the whole of last year we exported 275,000 tonnes. So while it's something you keep an eye on, there's plenty of lead times with a quota, and I expect that it could rear its head more toward the end of the year, that October, November to December region. Now again, if we've had a pretty ordinary season across the eastern states, the cattle aren't going to be there to blow the quota. And if we've had a very good season, perhaps there is the kilograms that we need to find other that they need to find other markets for.
AWN livestock agent Joe Wilkes says there's 7 months to shore up new markets for the above quota beef that will be hit by the Chinese tariffs.
Oh, there's been a bit of chat about it, but now we've had time to process what it actually means to us in the industry. I think everyone's come to terms with it, and it's not going to be an immediate effect. It could be, you know, 6 or 8 months down the track, if any.
And so what, people, you know, reasonably confident that Australia would be able to find a home for the beef that's above the Chinese quota that would be hit with the punitive tariffs?
Yeah, I think so, absolutely. Australia exports enough beef to not have a monopoly on the market, but certainly we are a wanted product. So I think we'll be able to find, especially with the time, 6 or 8 months down the track, we'll be able to find other places to send our beef overseas. Yes.
So if it's not the international trade that's influencing the market at the moment, what are the big issues locally? Is it simply the season?
I think absolutely our season's very, very tough here. Luckily, to the north of us, they were struggling with dam water over the last few months, but luckily there was a storm went through Christmas and gave them some of that water with 50 and 100 mils of rain. But if we didn't get that, we'd be in all sorts of trouble. As for feed, yeah, not a lot of feed in the paddock. Everything's getting supplementary fed now, so people are weighing up whether they should take the money now or put more money into their cattle and sheep.
And so is that being reflected in, the weight that's on stock that are coming through today in this first sale of the year?
Yeah, it certainly is. This is a very light yarding. There's not many true feeder-type cattle at 450 kilos plus here today. A lot of cattle more so 400 and 380 kilos and under. A lot of crossbred cattle, even weaners straight off their mothers coming straight into the sale. The cow job is pretty strong today. There's good cows here, but they're very low numbers. It is a low yarding, 1,700, but it is a first sale back, so I suppose people are a bit dubious and wanting to see how the market will open up.
And so given water starting to get perhaps a little bit short in the hills, drying conditions everywhere, are you expecting that that'll be reflected not only in the cattle market but also sheep and lambs?
Yeah, I think absolutely. You sort of see a future in feeding livestock, but when you've got to start cutting water to them, it makes your decision pretty easy that they've got to go no matter what they're worth. So I think you'll see it reflected, yeah.
Just under 2,000 head of cattle were yarded at Wagga yesterday. Adelong producer Gary Hindmarsh says there's still dry feed in the paddock, but it was time for some of his stock to go.
Yeah, we sold some little Hereford steers and heifers, about 350, 360 kilo. They went all right. Yeah, about 380, 390 a kilo was good.
Selling them off a little bit earlier than you would in a normal season?
Yeah, normally we'd try and get them up to that 450 kilo mark, but we just weren't going to get there on dry feed, so they're better off gone.
Steve from out at Lake Angelico, just a cattle farmer out there. It's been pretty ordinary up until a couple of weeks ago. We had two lots of rain before Christmas, 20 mils and 50, and it's not too bad now. We've got a bit of green pick for another 3 or 4 weeks probably.
Yeah, Jeff Willis from Ladysmith. Oh, the only green's on the loosened paddocks. There's no real green anywhere else. We've had a couple of storms, but yeah, nothing to do anything.
So what's that mean in terms of your livestock production?
Well, it hadn't been too bad, really, because it hasn't wrecked any dry feed, so the dry feed's hanging on pretty well. But the dams are starting to get a bit of a worry, you know, the water in the dams. So you need to be under a couple of storms. We need a couple of storms now to put a bit of water in the dams. That's the worry. We want the rain to stay away off the dry feed and just rain on the dams.
Funny you could organise that. And how's the market treated you today?
It hasn't been too bad, yeah. The cows are making 410, 420, so yeah, they're still holding up.
That's cattle producers at the sales at Wagga yesterday, ending that report from Emily Doak. Well, those first livestock markets for the year have all kicked off with sale yards filling across the state. In Tamworth yesterday, 765 cattle were penned and 2,509 sheep and lambs. And while patchy storms have delivered some much-needed rain for some, there were plenty of dry areas developing across the New England northwest. Local agent Tim Hollis told Lara Webster that despite some dry conditions, prices and demand held up for that first market of 2026.
Yeah, so the condition of the today's reduced yarding was very solid and good. What we saw was probably more positivity there than probably expected, but on the back of some big numbers last year where the beef job stayed very strong throughout, I think, you know, shows some very strong signs into 2026 as to a lot of positivity through, you know, in the market there today. Just even in a limited quality yarding, prices were positive, very positive, Lara.
What were some of the figures you've seen?
Yeah, so we saw some cows back up to sort of $3.80 a kilo and maybe a bit better than that even for some smart preg-tested cows from a renowned Angus breeder. Some feeder cattle, you know, the steer portion up to sort of $5 a kilo and we had a very good sale of some nice feeder heifers up to $4.80. So that's opened very strongly.
Where were you seeing a lot of the demand from for this first sale?
we saw some, you know, competition from both southern exporters and the northern exporters on the cows and the limited offering of export cattle that were available, and then local trade and local feedlotters were sort of. There was some northern activity, but mainly just local competition on the limited yarding, Lara.
Of course, we've had a lot of talk around those beef tariffs from China. How much of that has been a talking point at the sow yard at the moment?
Yeah, so today it was certainly a talking point, Lara. It will have some effect on our market, but our competitors are also hit with the same tariffs, Lara. So that is sort of one of the major four countries that we do export to, and it will have some effect, but so it does also have an effect on our competitors as well, Lara. So we are a wait and see, but it certainly didn't affect the prices there today. And on the back of some large offerings last year and the market going with them, I think, 2026 looks very positive moving forward on a fair to average season. It's the same old chestnut in our space as we just need the rain.
Yeah, and I imagine the weather's probably more front of mind at the moment, potentially, than those tariffs as well, I imagine, Tim Hollis.
Yeah, it is. But we've seen some very good rain through, say, central Queensland and everything, which will be strong with our store market, you know, moving forward into the next January, February. So parts of the southern areas have had a break in the season where they've had a couple of wretched years of weather. So, even though we're dry throughout the New England Northwest and we've sort of seen a windy, drier period over December, on a fair to average season, you know, the stocks still look good in the paddock and the cattle are putting it on. So we just need to, the storms to keep rolling in.
Yeah, and of course, it's not just the cattle job. You've also got the sheep as well. How have the sheep and lambs held up for that first market?
Yeah, very much a limited offering there today in the sheep and lamb space. There was lambs there make up to $380 and some better mutton there make up to sort of $250, probably in and around that $8 a kilo again. So on a very limited offering there today, that market looks to have held from over the Christmas break. And, yeah, I think we've seen a lot of producers go out of sheep just with you know, for various reasons other than, you know, the fact that they're probably a little bit higher maintenance and whatnot. But limited offering there today and the prices have held firm from where they finished in 2025.
That's Tamworth Livestock Agent Tim Hollis speaking there with Lara Webster. You're listening to the New South Wales Country Hour. It's coming up to 24 minutes past 12.
The Country Hour, celebrating 80 years.
European breeds thrown in the mix, some Simmentil and the odd Black Angus.
The Country Hour.
It's a bit of a fruit salad.
Celebrating 80 years of telling rural stories.
Food of the gods.
On ABC Radio.
Marketing and R&D body Meat and Livestock Australia says it's disappointed with China's new global measure on beef imports. Now, a 55% tariff, as we know, will apply to all beef imported from Australia this year above its 205,000-tonne quota. MLA's General Manager of International Markets, Andrew Cox, spoke about the issue with Kim Honan.
I think the future still looks bright in many markets, but of course this will represent a constraint to the demand that we can access within China, and I think that's disappointing for Australian exporters and Australian farmers. I think it's also disappointing for our Chinese customers. We've got fantastic program business that we've developed as an industry with Chinese customers, and as I said before, we've got the trust of Chinese consumers as well. We're known for our quality, for our food safety, nutrition, etc. And of course, from a marketing perspective, we'll keep working with those customers with a long-term view.
So how do you see this playing out globally? We've got 100,000 tonnes of beef that will need to be exported elsewhere. There'll be, you know, other exporters that fill their quota and will have to find other markets as well. Ultimately, are we going to see, you know, exporters really lose out here in Australia?
I think it's important to note that the context here, that the macro sort of environment, trading environment for beef is still very positive. The demand outstrips supply globally. American beef is still in somewhat short supply, so we're exporting very large amounts to North America, Canada, There's opportunities throughout, you know, Southeast Asia with economic growth, etc., and wonderful conditions, and once again, a popular product amongst consumers and customers there. We've got opportunities in the Middle East, we've got opportunities in the UK, and hopefully we'll be able to access a free trade agreement with Europe in the coming months, which will also open up another market opportunity for Australian exporters.
And will those importers pay as much as China did for our beef?
Well, it's a competitive space, so, you know, like in all markets, you want as many customers as you can. You don't want to be beholden to any one customer. Our industry's done a fantastic job over the years to develop a number of markets. We've got four or five large markets that take a range of cuts, but there's also 20, 30, 40 other markets below that that compete for product. So a wise exporter will make sure that they've got multiple customers for each cut. Of course, whilst China's set a quota, the quota's still over 200,000 tonnes, which is in line with the five-year average. Of course, it's been recently a little larger to China. It was, the US beef has been sort of cut out of that market. But we never know what will happen in the future. Obviously, the trade dynamic has been a little volatile in the last 12 months. But I think we're accustomed to volatility. If you look over any five-year period in the last 50, you'll have a number of volatile, you know, incidents that happen. And that's just how trade works.
Do you think there's any chances that China might change their tune and they may reduce the 55% tariff as the quota starts to fill up?
Yes, I'm not one to speculate on the decision-making of the Chinese authorities. So who knows? I mean, we'll just see how it plays out. We're still in the first week of January. I think there's a bit of discussion to be had between all affected parties. And I know that the Australian government is discussing this issue, this topic, with their counterparts. So obviously we'd hope for relief because, as I said, we believe that we put an extremely strong case forward that any damages to the Chinese cattle industry are not at all caused by our industry. So we'd hope that that would be taken into consideration as we go forward.
And have you heard anything from Chinese importers or consumers about how they're feeling?
Yeah, I think the Chinese side, our customers there are working through what this might mean. I think there's still, as we sort of discussed today, there's still a fair few unknowns about how this quota will be managed, or all these quotas will be managed, how they'll be reported, what it means for the product mix that will be going in. A lot of the customers that we have in China are program businesses taking chilled beef for retail shelves, much the same as you might see at Woolworths or Coles. So that sort of requires monthly shipments, and a 55% tariff would create obviously some economic challenges there. So they need to work through what this means for their businesses, and will support each supply chain that's involved in the Australian beef, in importing Australian beef to maximise the potential opportunity for them.
And we've heard a commentary around this tariff having more of an impact on high-end premium products exported from Australia. Is that accurate, do you think?
I think it's hard to say. The most likely solution that you'd commercially look at would probably be frozen imports, because you can obviously freeze that product and then draw down on cold stores for a few months after the quota kicks in. That obviously would not be good at all for chilled beef shipments, grain-fed beef shipments, Wagyu shipments, etc., because, as I said, they have a shorter shelf life, chilled beef, and therefore rely on programmatic exports. So, yes, that's a risk for Australia, because we are the largest exporter of chilled beef into China. So we'd certainly be trying to protect that market, because it is a market that we don't believe competes directly with Chinese cattle. Often found on premium retail shelves, targeting a different type of consumer. So that was the points that we put forward in our submissions to the Chinese authorities. And as I said, we would have hoped that would be taken into consideration.
So how do you think Australia should manage this 205,000-tonne quota? China's a very important market for so many exporters. They're going to be scrambling to get their beef into there before the quota fills up, probably mid-year is what I'm hearing. There has been suggestions that perhaps that the federal government should be working with the industry peak bodies on coming up with a quota system to make it fair for all exporters. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that's probably one for the peak bodies themselves. Meat must not want it peak bodies. So that would be that the Australian Meat Industry Corporation and Cattle Australia would be discussing with Canberra. It's quite early. Obviously, the announcement came on Christmas Day, and we don't know how the quota will be managed. It's a decision initially for the Chinese side. We obviously manage a lot of different quotas all around the world, and that has to be negotiated between our government and the importing nation as well. So I think it's probably too early to say exactly how these quotas will be managed. But of course, what we'd want as an industry would be orderly quota management to avoid a sort of, you know, race to the bottom early on in each year.
Talking about the situation in regards to those China tariffs, Andrew Cox is the General Manager of International Markets at Meat and Livestock Australia. It's coming up to 12:30.
The Country Hour, celebrating 80 years.
Dun, dun, dun. That's right,
we're 3 hours from Catherine, doing School of the Air.
Celebrating 80 years of telling rural stories on ABC Radio.
New gun laws will take effect in New South Wales this year, but the call for exemptions for farmers and sporting shooters are getting louder. Recreational gun licence holders will be able to own a maximum of 4 guns under the new laws, while farmers can have up to 10. But the limits have been labelled ridiculous by some shooters. Steve Bingley is the Executive Officer of the National Rifle Association of Australia and told David Claughton, gun owners support changes to make Australia safer, but the limit of 10 for farmers and sports shooters is not enough.
I've spoken to many sporting shooters. I've got a farming background as well. So I understand that, you know, there are certain firearms that are for certain roles. And, you know, such as with the sport, there are multiple disciplines and you have different rifles for those different disciplines. And having a cap of 10, it does make it logistically difficult.
So independent MB Roy Butler is pushing to scrap the cap on firearms. Is that something that you would also support?
I would leave that to the matter for the Parliament, where our job is the sport of long-range full bore target shooting. And so we would advocate for our members to be able to increase that cap.
To what?
I would not be able to give you a figure. We're just speculating. So I can't give you a number such as 15, 20, 25, 30 because everybody's needs are different.
Steve Bingley, there are almost 400 gun clubs around Australia and many have been operating for up to 100 years. Nathan Smith is a club captain at the Spring Ridge Rifle Club. He says he's got well over 10 guns to cover his use on the farm and in competitive shooting. A limit of 10, he says, will force him and others to give up some competitions.
So I've got firearms for animal welfare. I've got firearms for feral animal control. I shoot multiple disciplines of target shooting. So again, I've got multiple firearms for each discipline, along with shooting pistols as well. To keep going in the sport, I can either cherry pick which sport I want to do and give up part of my sport because I can't give up the firearms for the animal welfare on the farm or feral animal control.
Well, it sounds like it's going to affect sport shooting because you just can't hold the number of guns you need for the different sorts of competition.
100% of them, yeah.
Australia has a tradition of gun ownership that goes back a long way, and shooting is Australia's sixth most successful sport at Olympic level. Ben Ems is a gun club at his property at Lyndhurst in central west New South Wales, and he's a world champion shooter. He told David Claughton there's no need for a cap on guns. The gun licensing laws are there to assess who is a fit and proper person.
You're either a fit person to own a firearm and have a firearms licence, or you're not. Regulating how many you can have, I think it's... Like, I don't think it achieves anything. Like, once you can own one, once you're a fit person to own and have a licence, I just don't see what the limit achieves. But if the limit is what the limit is, you know, we'll move on with life and deal with it.
But if there was a limit of 10, which is mm-hmm. people are talking about for farmers,
yep.
right? But you're
yep.
a farmer and a sports shooter. So how yep. many guns do you need?
I suppose how many do you need? Look, as far as the target shooting goes, and I'm, you know, a fairly high up target shooter, I'd have half a dozen different target rifles, which, you know, I can live with that. You know, and then running the farm, you know, I could survive with another half a dozen. You know, like, yes, it'd be fine to have, you know, you'd like to be able to hold more. It's just, I suppose at the moment I'd own 30 firearms, a lot of which sit in the cupboard and never see light of day. Does that mean I want to just hand them in? No. Do I see any reason why I should? No, other than, you know, a bureaucrat's going to change the law and say we've got to. Does it achieve anything? No, probably not.
That's Ben Ems, who is Central West Stock and Station Agent and the 2015 Target Shooting World Champion. You're listening to The Country Hour.
The Country Hour, celebrating 80 years.
Every year is different.
The Country Hour.
It's about connecting with people.
Part of your community for 80 years.
Beautiful.
Weekdays at noon on ABC Radio and on the ABC Listen app.
So Graham McCamley has passed away at the age of 93. Known as a modern-day pioneer and champion of the nation's beef industry, the Central Queensland grazier lived an extraordinary life, from founding the Cattlemen's Union to helping develop the Brahman breed through work with the CSIRO and Queensland University and playing a pivotal role in saving the life of Joe Bielke Peterson's son. His influence stretched across agriculture, politics and rural Australia. Brett Coombs was a family friend with Sir Graham, and he told Jeremy Jones about his legacy.
I was probably lucky enough, and my father was who did the beef expos, but Dad had a close relationship with Graham from the 60s, early 60s, I guess, with the Brahman breed. And we also lived at Marlborough Station, which wasn't far from Tartarus, and then we moved to Waverley then in the 70s. And we had a good relationship with Graham and Shirley and Jackie and Jenny and Russell, the kids that, you know, we were, as kids, we did a lot of stuff together. And, yeah, it went on later in life. I was lucky enough to work at Tartarus on a few times doing AI programs and whatnot. And, you know, Graham was an innovator. There's no doubt about that. You know, what he did was just amazing.
How would you describe the legacy that he leaves behind?
Well, I guess, you know, the thing with Graham that always got me with him was, you know, he was always thinking, you know, like you could talk to Graham and, you know, he'd fly, I'd be AI and cows, he'd fly in and ask me how I was going, how many I'd done or whatever. And, you know, he'd look at him and he'd look straight past you and, you know, he was thinking about what else he could be doing or whatever. So he was certainly an outside the box thinker. And, you know, there's no doubt that the Briggalo development and you know, the use of pivots and irrigation and all that setup that he set up at Tartarus and Royals was his foresight. And, you know, the use of choppers, you know, he was a, you know, blade ploughing. I mean, all those things, you know, obviously I'm not saying that Graham developed, but he certainly was an innovator in getting him in there and just getting stuff done. He was amazing like that, yeah.
What can you tell us about his contribution to the breed?
Well, you know, back in the 60s, Jeff and his brother, Graham and his brother Jeff, basically, Jeff had Lancefield and Graham had Tartarus, and they started the Tartarus Lancefield site, and they both had, you know, were certainly big stud breeders then, but they started their sale, and I think it was about 50 years, about 2 years ago, so, you know, that was back in the 70s, I guess. I'm working out the numbers, but unfortunately the Tartarus aren't in that sale anymore, but you know, there was probably 48 years of, you know, just the Tartarus Lancefield sale was a, you know, it was a monumental event every year. You know, you'd go there, but the ones that started the night sales, and there'd be glitter, and you know, it was pretty amazing. And certainly Graham and Jeff, his brother, they certainly, you know, were innovators in all that, and they were the guys that, you know, they obviously had cattle in here from the 50s imports, but they were the ones that went over there in the late 70s and imported cattle with a lot of the other pioneers, Rob Innes and, you know, I don't need to name them all, but there was a lot of fellas that, well, there was a core group of probably 10 breeders that really brought a lot of cattle in the 70s and 80s, and Graham was certainly amongst them. And, you know, they certainly, you know, showed cattle, and they had performance. They, you know, they were big in the performance recording. They did a lot of steer fattening and carcass competitions, and yeah, he certainly was an innovator. And I guess the one thing I do remember about Graham is, you know, he was president of the Brahman Breeders back in the early 70s, and the beef depression started in 74, and I can tell you I was only high, being promiscuous then, but I do remember, you know, that no sooner had the beef depression started, Graham McCamley wasn't going to put up with this low price for beef. I think he opened two butcher shops in Rocky, and you know, he was always thinking outside the box, like I said, and you know, that's where I got to tip my hat to him. And and you know, he developed a great thing up Tartarus there. It was an amazing setup. I know they had a big field day there back probably 20 years ago now, but it was, you know, just to see the setup, the you know, and he certainly had some great staff, you know, the Catons and old you know, Frank Titmus, Frank and Pauline, they were there for a long time, and you know, there were some guys that really stuck by him, and you know, he ended up with Curtis Island, I think, and you know, he certainly spread his wings. He went up north to Richmond, and some of that irrigation up there he got going, and then he developed Royals, and you know, that was, you know, amazing, all the flood irrigation and the centre pivots and the water harvesting, and yeah, so it was a pretty amazing setup, and what he did in his lifetime was, you know, most of us would be flat-footing it into three lifetimes.
You mentioned the 70s there, and he was good friends with your dad. Does this make you reflect on that time and what it was like then?
Well, to be honest, I guess for us, for kids in the 70s, we were all at boarding school. My dad worked for Stanbrook, so we were sent away to boarding school. So we just went there to play footy and bury our head in the sand, I guess. But in thinking about it, it certainly was a tough time for beef producers. But I just remember that, you know, Graham, I can remember him talking to Dad about it one time, and he, you know, like I said, he was a man that if he said he was going to do something, he usually did it, and that's what happened. He started his butcher shops and then kept going with that sort of type of thing.
And when you reflect on him, what do you think about?
Oh, look, I just tip my hat to Graham, because like I said, he was an innovator, and you know, there's certainly been, you know, over the years, you know, and this is what happens to people with an amazing mind, is that, you know, certainly some of the projects haven't all been successful, and you know, he's landed flat on his back on more than one occasion, and probably chucked a couple of choppers out of the sky, I think, and you know, but you know, you always got back up and get going again, and I guess that's the epitome of living in the bush. You know, we get floods, we get droughts, and you know, Graham just he never gave up, and he's tough. And but I guess for me, it was his innovative thought, and he just never stopped thinking about what he could do next.
And it was stories of saving the Queensland Premier's son at the time, and the helicopters too. There's a lot of incredible stories there. And even that despite his properties, at times he'd be living in a camper van just to look at his properties.
Yeah, that's right. Graham was quite happy to roll a swag out in the camp anyway. He didn't need to be in the best resort in the world. But yeah, he was, like I said, he was a bit of a doer, and he, you know, he could spin that chop around. I've seen him on a few occasions, probably not the most stress-free stock handling you'd see today, but he'd get the job done. And that's sometimes you just, as much as we love to do all that stuff, sometimes you just got to do what you got to do to get the job done.
Brett Coombs is a friend of Sir Graham McCamley, who's just died at the age of 93, and Brett was speaking to Jeremy Jones. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's coming up to 20 minutes to one. Time to get some weather details now. As you on Park at the Bureau, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Marco.
So we're seeing a few storms around the place, but not that many, and it's generally heating up.
Yes, that's right. Today, we may still see some developmental isolated showers or thunderstorms in the state's northeast and on the southern and central ranges this afternoon and early this evening. But these showers and storms will be very much isolated and probably very likely to be non-severe. And also the maximum temperatures today will be in mid to high 20s in the east, tending mid 30s to near 40s in the west. Then, as you said, we expect generally very hot and dry weather conditions to prevail from midweek onward until Saturday. as a slow-moving high-pressure system over the Tasman Sea strengthens while driving hot northerly airstream across the state. So with that, from tomorrow onward, the temperature rises will be notable as we expect several degrees of temperature rise across the southern and the western and central inland areas of the state. And then during the second half of this week, we may see the maximum temperatures rising to, say, high 30s to mid 40s in many areas across the southern, western, and central areas, while the minimum temperatures will be staying high teens to low 20s in many areas. So with this, a severe heat wave warning has been issued for the south coast and central tablelands and Monaro country and the ACT. And these severe heat wave conditions is likely to spread to other southern and central and western districts, while escalating to maybe extreme heat wave conditions mainly over the southeast quarter over the coming days. And something I want to mention is that this upcoming heat wave event is likely to be the most significant heat wave event since the 2019 to 2020 summer season, because of several days of prolonged heat stresses and conditions. So with that, these heat wave conditions may pose some health risk, especially to elderly and vulnerable people.
Yeah, and the hottest since 2019, 2020, which is when we saw the bushfires, of course. So, and there has been a bushfire warning out from some climatologists too, because of the dry conditions, particularly in the south, northern Victoria, southern parts of the state, things drying off very, very rapidly there. But there is a change coming, on the weekend, is it?
Yes, that's right. So looks like the fire danger conditions will be rising to high fire dangers in many parts of the state, driven by this heat from midweek onward. Perhaps peaking on Saturday ahead of the cooler southerly changes. So now with that, several districts in the southeastern and central eastern areas may see extreme fire dangers on Saturday because of freshening northwesterly winds combined with the heat, posing escalated fire danger conditions. And then once the southerly changes move through Saturday into Sunday, this will probably bring cooler changes across the southern, western, and the eastern areas, maybe except the northern inland areas. And so with these changes, you may see southerly buster crossing across Illawarra and the Sydney coast maybe during the latter part of Saturday.
Much rain with it, do you think?
No, not really. But the temperature drop will be notable in the wake of these changes, and that will probably bring us relief from the temperatures.
Okay, Juan, thanks for that. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
You're listening to The Country Hour.
You're listening to The Country Hour.
On ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello, I'm Annie Guest. Join me for The World Today. With experts positing a laundry list of potential motivations behind Donald Trump's Venezuelan intervention, we hear the latest from the US. The livestock toll in the North Queensland floods expected to rise as water levels remain high and authorities monitor a potential cyclone. And as South Australia's algal bloom creates uncertainty for beachgoers, elsewhere the state celebrates a tourism boost.
That's coming up on The World Today. Well, it may not always feel like it, but a harvester is a lot easier now than it was a century ago. That's something that Lee Baker, who farms at Wild Horse Plains, 75 kilometres north of Adelaide, knows only too well. Lee is an avid collector of old machinery, and this harvest he put a 95-year-old Sunshine auto header to work. His grandfather bought the machine in 1950 before Lee bought it from him in the late 1970s. Though he doesn't know how often it's actually been used, he heard stories about it from his father.
I remember Dad telling me they got it stuck in a foxhole when they had steel wheels on it, and then after they got it stuck, they pulled it out and they got a local engineering mob at Yorktown, put rubber tyres on it.
And so what made you, why did you want to buy it?
I just like old things, and I thought that's the only sentimental thing that I was going to get from the family.
And what kind of quality was it in when you got it?
Didn't go, I towed it home, and then I brought it back here and put it in our shed, and then I drug it out about 40 years later. When I had a triple bypass, I lost all motive in life, and I thought, well, I'd do something. I got that out, freed it all up, the knife was seized, probably had a wheelbarrow load of rat manure in the thrasher. The thrasher was seized, there was sheepskin parts all through it, and then I bought a new set of plugs and got my cousin to make a new exhaust, and we towed it probably 10 metres and it started. And it starts reasonably good now. And we bought a new header this year, my son did, so I just wanted to put a comparison between the new one and the old one to say that the old still can do the job.
So you took it out a couple of weeks ago. Was that the first time you've had it out working?
Well, I had it out 4 years ago, but only did a little bit that time just to get it going. Then we put it in the shed, and then, yeah, I thought I'd get it out this year. And all I wanted was a photo next to the new ones, next to the old one, so I can put it on the wall.
And how did it run out in the paddock?
It ran quite well, actually. Well, it ran out of petrol once, because I only had the little tank full of petrol. I didn't, because it runs on kerosene. I haven't got kerosene, so filled the little tank of petrol up. We went, and then it ran out, so I put some more in it, and then we got it going again and did a bit more. It did get fairly hot. I suppose it was a warm day, but I suppose we're not used to sitting so close to the motor. We're all, nowadays, we're just used to sitting in air-conditioned cab and luxury. And GPS, whereas this takes a little bit to steer it and to work out how to use the header. Like, you need to start probably 10 metres before you actually get to the crop. You need to put, because it's only got one clutch, so you need to put the header in gear and the drive gear in gear at the same time. So you need to hit the crop at full speed with the header going. So that took a little bit to get used to how to work that one out.
What else is different from this compared to the new stuff?
I suppose the air-conditioned cab and auto steer, I suppose. I couldn't get the young ones to drive it.
What's the process?
It holds approximately 3 to 4 bags, the little box. And then you have somebody on the side which bags it off, and then I think it holds 10 or 11 bags on the bagging platform. Then when you've filled that, you go over and you put all the bags together and someone sews the bags up.
How many did you get when you took it out?
Oh, we only did 2 or 3 bags.
How long did that take?
Probably, I don't know, we're out there mucking around for an hour by the time we got it worked out how to work it. I want to get it out in 5 years' time when it's 100 years old. I'm going to play with it a bit more and get the rust out of it more, and now that I'm starting to get used to how to work it. It has got an instruction book, but I should have read that first, I suppose.
I think it's pretty normal for a farmer not to read an instruction book, from what I know.
I think you're right there. I don't think you get parts for it anymore, unless you find an old one that's wrecked to get the parts off it.
And in terms of the front, how does it cut compared to the new stuff?
Well, this is like a comb front, the old style. And the new ones are all open front, so they don't block up as much. They're open front, the new ones, whereas these seem to block up if you got turnip or rubbish in your crop as well. You'll have more trouble with these feeding than what the new ones. But I suppose when you look at it, they're basically the same principle. It cuts it off, goes up into the thrasher and thrash it, and then it goes through over the walkers, whereas this has got walkers, the new ones don't have walkers. I like playing with old stuff, and I just like mucking around with it. I've always liked old stuff.
Lee Baker speaking there to Isabella Kelly about his vintage farm machinery.
The Country Hour.
Celebrating 80 years.
Understanding how they grow best.
The Country Hour.
Nourishing the people in their own community.
Part of your community for 80 years.
Highly regarded.
Weekdays at noon.
Go straight to the source.
On ABC Radio and on the ABC Listen app.
The Northern Territory mango harvest has finished up, but fruit is still coming off the trees in WA and Queensland, where the harvest has been slightly delayed by rain. Australian Mango CEO Trevor Dunmore spoke to Tom Robinson about how the sector's shaping up in the new year across the country.
Queensland growers are still in the middle of picking, and also some of our growers in Carnarvon in Western Australia. So still the season continues, and the North Queensland's, as you're probably aware, has been in a fair bit of rain. So I think that's held up growers a little bit, but you know, I think it's, the harvest is still proceeding. As far as you know, Northern Territory growers, I think they've had a reasonable season. They've had a last few seasons have been fairly tough for many of the growers in the north. This season a little bit better, but you know, we're still, growers are always looking for better returns. So yeah, hopefully this year Darwin and Territory growers will get a good start of a wet season. That'll continue, and then we get a good dry season through, you know, through from April through to September.
We'll come back to the weather in Queensland. In terms of the season in the Territory, are there any figures that you have on hand that you can point to?
Not at this stage. No, we're still collecting that data. So, but it was production was in a similar range to last year, so we still expect, you know, the Territory to producing just over 50% of Australian production, which will probably be about 4.5 million trays this last season.
Are there policy or advocacy positions that you'll be considering in the new year?
The big ones for us are, and continuing, is our battle to get our compliance systems into a place where logic is more important than bureaucracy. The food safety and ethical employment of staff and workers is really critical and really important, but the red tape and bureaucracy have overtaken logic, and so that's one of our key areas. The palm scheme certainly has been very good for growers who use palm workers. It's a really great system, but again, bureaucracy and some of the rules and regulations are making the scheme unworkable for some growers. So those are the areas that continue to need further work, not just for mangoes, but for horticulture in general.
When you say that bureaucracy and red tape, you're particularly focusing in on employment of seasonal workers?
Just the conditions around employment and the as far as, you know, there are double standards, and it's making, and the rules and regulations are making it very difficult for employers, and so therefore we need some, you know, logic and common sense to be brought into the system. So, you know, as I said, the palm scheme has been very good for many growers, and beneficial also for the workers and you know, their families. So we want a system that is fair and equitable for everybody.
You did mention before the weather in Queensland. There's a TV on in the studio here with the ABC banner, livestock losses expected from flooding in northwest Queensland. Has there been impact on the mango sector due to this weather?
From our understanding, I haven't spoken to any growers in the last couple of days, but they haven't had in the Maribyrnong area, they've had some rain, but not to the extent that northwestern Queensland has had. And obviously our hearts go out to those growers and graziers and, you know, potential stock losses. So that's obviously very devastating for them. Our growers, I think at this stage, it's just, you know, harvest has been delayed, but it's still continuing in between showers. Our next concern is that, you know, there have been some transport disruptions because of, you know, some flooding of roads, but I think that's only been a minor disruption at this stage. We'll have to wait to see over the next few days what happens.
That's Australian Mango CEO Trevor Dunmore speaking in the air to Tom Robinson. To markets now. And let's go to Gunnedah cattle.
Gunnedah Pen 720 mixed cattle numbers down 2,300 on the final sale of 2025. Trends were mixed with a positive influence through all heifer categories. Steers to a softer trend with quality corrections. A major feeder buyer absent, other regular buyers present and operating. Light steers to feed nearer 420 to 482. Medium feeders much cheaper 350 to 462. Quality driven, as were heavy feeders, down 449 to 462. Heavy processors again 26, 470 to 490. Light heifers to background to strong competition 350 to 424. Similar feeders much dearer, selling to 442. Medium feeders and background is considerably dearer, averaging 447 and 462 respectively. Heavy processors 468 to 488. Heavy heifers to feed much dearer, 396 to 463. Grown heifers to process 340 to 472. Heavy four-score cows to a premium, 390 to 431. Heavy bulls dearer, 358 to 387. Stephen Adams, MLA at Canada.
You've been listening to The Country Hour, heading up to news time.